This is what I said. George R. R. Martin is not your bitch, no matter how much you gripe. George R. R. Martin is not your bitch, you might as well go get a life.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Functional Nerds. My name is Luca. I live on the second floor. Hi, John.
Hey, how you doing, Patrick? I that is actually Patrick Hester. He lives on the first floor. He's lying about his name and where he lives.
Yes, I think you've seen me before.
I have. You know, I made a reference to that song to a coworker, and they didn't know what I was talking about. And they're only like 5 years younger than me, and I was like really annoyed at them because I'm like, you know that song. Come on. Anyway, my name is John Anilio. I am a singer-songwriter, and I write songs about science fiction and fantasy. And the song that you heard at the beginning of the episode, George R. R. Martin Is Not Your Bitch, is one of my songs. And it is available now on an EP called Books, Bites, and Bots. And you can get that at johnanilio.bandcamp.com for as little as free.
And I have to say, as cool as those songs are, the artwork's pretty nice too.
Yes, and Patrick helped me out by doing the artwork on that. So there's a link on the Functional Nerds site to it as well. So go check it out. And like I said, you can download it for free. If you want to give me a couple bucks, that's cool too. But I figured with Game of Thrones opening it up this week, I figure very appropriate to have that song out there this week. So go and check that out. Anyway, so my co-host here is Patrick Hester. He is an author and a blogger and a podcast dude. And this week, you know, I've taken a couple of breaks the past few weeks, and this week it's sort of Patrick got to take a break because I interviewed Devo Spice, who is a dementia artist, as he refers to himself in the interview. He does
Dr. Demento.
Yes, he is big on the Dr. Demento show and has been for quite a long time. You know, I mistakenly referred to Devo Spice as a nerdcore artist, and he's not quite a nerdcore artist, although there is a lot of overlap between what he does and what the nerdcore guys do. So Devo was nice enough to invite me to his home. We don't live that far away from each other. So we did the interview in his home. You will hear a little dog chain running around at points. So I hope that is not too distracting to listen to. But Devo and I got into lots of cool things. We talked a lot about how we got started. We both talked about music recording quite a bit. We went quite a bit on that. So if you are a nerd about music recording, you're going to like a lot of this interview. We talked quite in depth about that and about getting your music out there in the internet age and promoting yourself and all that kind of jazz. And Devo does have a new album out, and we will play a track from that at the end. So hope you enjoy this interview. All right. I'm sitting down with one Devo Spice, would we call yourself a nerdcore superstar?
I think superstar's pushing it. Yeah. I'm technically a dementia artist, okay. Which is a comedy musician. Mm-hmm. A couple of years ago, people who do comedy music decided we didn't like the term novelty music anymore. So we came up with a new name for the genre. And I think it was the great Luke Ski who suggested dementia after Dr. Demento.
Okay.
So technically I'm a dementia artist, but nobody knows what that genre is.
Okay.
But I am a comedy musician. There's a huge overlap with the nerdcore community because I am a nerd. So a lot of the nerdy stuff gets worked into my music, but a lot of my music isn't nerdy as well. So there's...
Cool. Well, let's, you know, I especially if I'm talking to another musician, I'm always very curious as to how you get started, because I think, you know, everybody has slightly different paths to getting to where they are currently. So how did you get started doing music when you were, if you were a kid, or was it something later in life?
No, I was definitely a kid. I've always been interested in funny songs, you know, just singing, you know, stupid parodies on the playground, you know, mostly about farts and blowing up the school and stuff that would get you arrested nowadays, probably. So I was always singing these stupid songs, and it was always in the back of my head. And then my mother played for me an Alan Sherman record. It was his fifth album for Swingin' Livers Only, and the first track is Grow Mrs. Goldfarb, which is a parody of Little Glowworm, about a man's tribute to his excessively obese wife. And this song made me laugh so hard. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this is on a record. This somebody got paid to make this. You mm-hmm. can make a living doing this. This is awesome. Mm-hmm. So I very quickly, from Alan Sherman, I discovered Weird Al and Dr. Demento and all the other people who are involved in that scene. Mm-hmm. And then, but those are, comedy music spans all sorts of different genres. Mm-hmm. The first genre of music I ever really liked was rap. Mm-hmm. I got into breakdancing very young, and then on the radio I was listening to one of the stations out of New York City, and I heard, I think it was either Beat Street Breakdown or it was some Melly Mel song or something mm-hmm. like that, and I was fascinated by the rhythm really captured me, and I was fascinated by the fact that this guy could go for 5 minutes at a time without breathing. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this is awesome. So I very quickly got into hip hop, and some of the, you know, like the Fat Boys were an early favorite of mine because they're funny as well.
How old are you at this point?
Like, I was 9 or 10.
Okay.
When that was mm-hmm. happening. So, and then I got into like LL Cool J and Houdini and Run DMC and the Beastie Boys and people like that. So when I started writing my own lyrics to songs, rap was the first thing that I started writing, and it was only natural for me to try to make it funny. Mm-hmm. So from a very early age, I combined the two things, and mm-hmm. I've been doing it ever since because I don't know when to quit. Mm-hmm. So.
Now, so if hip hop was your first love and you were kind of making up your songs at a pretty early age, at what point do you start actually recording yourself, and do you start kind of making your own beats and your own tracks and stuff pretty early on, or when does that start? And
started very early on. I took the lead and decided I was going to form a rap group, and we called ourselves Sudden Death, which was not my idea. We formed in 1986, and then it took us a year and a half to record our first song, which was no instruments. It was just me doing human beatbox sound effects and the other two guys doing the vocals. Mm-hmm. And from there I decided, you know what, we need instruments. I can't do this on every song. And mm-hmm. I borrowed a cheap Casio keyboard, and that was our band for the longest time, was whatever pre-programmed beats were on that thing and whatever I could pull out of it. Mm-hmm. And we put out some of the worst crap you could ever possibly imagine.
And when do you get into like doing your own sequencing and stuff, or was it pretty much just what was built into that and then you'd sort of play along with it? Or like
the Sudden Death music, it was a very gradual progression. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, we'd go for a while with this piece of machinery, and then, you know, Dave bought a drum machine. And then we had a drum machine, you know, and then we would, you know, we'd go with that for a while. And then I bought a mixer, so we had, you know, better sounding recordings because we were going directly into the radio as opposed mm-hmm. to sitting a boombox in the middle of the floor and recording into the open air microphone, which is how mm-hmm. we did it for about a year.
Yeah.
And it was a very gradual progression. And then, you know, later I started recording I got a 4-track for my 18th birthday, you know, so I was recording on that. And then, you know, I would, you know, it was like in the mid 90s, I had a Power Mac 7100, and I was recording the music on that and then bouncing that to my 4-track and putting the vocal, doing the vocals on the 4-track, because I had no way to do the vocals on the mm-hmm. computer at the time. So
what were you doing on the, like what program were you running on?
Sound Edit.
Okay.
Sound Edit 16.
Okay.
Which is to this day the greatest wave editor I've ever seen, and okay. nothing has quite come close. Amadeus is probably the closest program okay. I've seen to Sound Edit, but Sound Edit can still do a couple of things that Amadeus can't do. So, and then from there I got into MIDI sequencing, and I bought a really nice keyboard, which I still have. I've had it for like 10 years now. Mm-hmm. And then
what kind of keyboard for?
It's an Alesis QS7.1. Mm-hmm. And I still don't know how to use the whole thing. It's got 7 million functions and 4 buttons. I just don't know how this works. Mm-hmm. But and then I get into MIDI sequencing, and you know, and things would gradually progress. And now what I'm using is I have a 10-year-old computer in the other room. It's a Power Mac G4, mm-hmm. which I upgraded the processor, so it's a dual 1.6 gigahertz. Mm-hmm. I do MIDI sequencing in a program called Renoise, which I just discovered about 4 or 5 months
ago. Right, I remember you tweeting about
that. Yeah, absolutely love Renoise. Mm-hmm. Absolutely fantastic program. I do MIDI sequencing in that, and then I bounce down the wave files and put them into Logic, and then I record the the vocals either. I think I'm doing in Amadeus right now. I record the vocals in Amadeus and then put those into Logic and do my mixing and mastering in Logic. And then I send it all to Steve Goody and he makes it sound good.
Good. Well, you know, and it's funny, you're talking about the various keyboards and stuff you have, and they have all these a million functions and all that. And, you know, I think anybody who does any sort of music creating, whether it's whatever your style is, you go through this period where you're trying to figure out how to record yourself or to get your sounds or what have you and figure out what your sound is. And, you know, you can kind of get in this thing where you get almost like, I guess one way to put it is like a gear lust where you're like, if I just get this, then I can sound great. But what I've kind of learned over the years from doing this stuff and trying to figure out what my sound was and how I wanted to record it is that you can really get almost anything to sound good or to do what you want. It's just you have to work it. And a lot of times the best results you can have are when you have something that's maybe a little bit older that you've been using for a while, because you figure out how to do everything. And I use Logic myself, and I've been using it now for, I don't know, 7 or 8 years. And I'm sure I'm only using 5% of what it can do.
Yeah.
But for the most part, at this point, I know how to do what I want to do on it.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, I'm using Logic 8 now. And I think it's up to 9. I think I've even heard that 10 might be coming out.
I think I'm using 7.
Yeah. And I only upgraded to 8 because I needed to get it. My old computer died. And to get the new computer, I had to buy a whole new Logic for it. So anyway, the point is that I think there's a lot to be said about sort of the ingenuity of, like, using the hell out of what you have, like just really sitting with it for hours on end and figuring it out. Because, you know, especially nowadays with the various recording programs and everything else, they all do pretty much, they can all pretty much do the same thing. You just have to figure out how to get it to do it. Some things are better than others, and there are certain features that the other one can't do. But whether you use Pro Tools or Logic or Cubase or any of that stuff, you know, at this point, once one of them comes out with some sort of big feature, you know, the other one eventually has their version of it a year later. And now you just kind of see them all doing essentially the same things. But I know I went through the same thing where I, you know, had a 4-track, and then I had, you know, the first PC I had this thing called N-Track Studios, which is this piece of, like, shareware that, like, was a decent... So, you know, you're just trying to, like, make your stuff and just kind of figure out how to do it. So the thing is, you have to just sit down and do stuff with it.
Yeah,
so,
and the problem I had was that a lot of the... Whenever there was a new piece of technology involved, it got in the way of the creative process.
Yes.
So it's like, when I got my 4-track, I had to sit down and figure out how to use it. And then I didn't use it properly because I didn't know how to use it. I got it used and it didn't come with a manual. So it wasn't until I went to college and I happened to become friends with a guy who had the same model. He sat me down for a couple hours and he said, okay, this is how you do this and this is how you do that. So I learned how to use it. And then I used that thing for a long ass time because I knew how to use it, and it was very easy to hit record, play something on my keyboard. There was no MIDI. I wasn't using MIDI at the time, so it was just all live recording, doing what I could, bouncing tracks back and forth, and, you know, I'd record 35 tracks on a 4-track, just bouncing things back and forth. It didn't sound good, but I did it.
Yeah.
You know, and when MIDI stymied me for the longest time. I had no idea what MIDI was or how it functioned or what it did, and it wasn't until somebody explained to me that MIDI is like sending data to a printer to be printed. You're not sending the image to the printer. You're sending information that tells the printer how to print. Mm-hmm. And the music software does the same thing. It's sending information to the keyboard to tell the keyboard how to play. And I went, oh, okay, that makes sense. And then I was like, I'm going to figure out MIDI. So I had this keyboard, and I bought the keyboard first. And then I was like, it has this MIDI function. I should learn how to use it. I have a computer. This is stupid. So I sat down and the program came with a demo version of Logic, which wasn't owned by Apple at the time, and it was impossible to figure out.
Yeah.
It had the worst interface. I'm like, I don't know what I'm looking at. I don't know what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. So I picked up Cubase, liked that a lot better, and used Cubase for many, many years. And then I think what happened was I upgraded to 10.4 or 10.5, I forget which, on my computer, and my version of Cubase wouldn't run anymore. And I was like, you know what, let me try Logic. And then I got into Logic. Mm-hmm. And the problem I had with Logic was that my 10-year-old computer is too slow to do the MIDI.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it won't work. It like stutters, and you know, which is impossible. You're trying to play a melody and get it in rhythm, and
yeah, sure.
You can't do it if it can't keep up. So I had to find another program, and I found one piece of crap shareware program that I didn't like at all. Used that for like two songs and then gave up on it, and then really started researching something better and found Renoise. Mm-hmm. And then I watched some of the demos on Renoise, and I was like, you know what? I think I'll like this. And then I tried the demo version, and within an hour I was like, sold, and I bought the program. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I think a lot of times it's finding what works. As you said before, you don't want to have it, you know, trip up your creative process.
If you're spending too much time figuring out how to do something technically, you're like, I just want, you hit record, you hit play over here, and it should work. And,
I know for me, a lot of times, just figuring out how to get good sounds, because, like, you know, I'll play guitar, and, you know, so the sound of my guitar, I know how to make that sound good. I know how to make, you know, but if ever I'm doing any sort of like drum programming or even loops, or if I'm doing some sort of synth sound or something in it, it took me the longest time to get those sounding the way I wanted to, because, you know, you'll start with the presets, and those always, I think they're called, you know, they make those things sound good in a music store. So when you're sitting there, they sound awesome. But like when you're trying to work it into a track with like your singing and some guitars or what have you, it's too much. It's way too much. So it took me a long time to sort of figure out how to sort of tone them down or just get them. So now, and then once you get them to where you want, then you save them as presets. And then, you know, you're going to tweak them song by song and whatever you want. But then you know how to get it. And I think that's an important part. Now, I'm sure all the musicians who are listening to this are loving all that, but let's get some stuff. So through all of that, are you gigging through all that? Are you guys playing shows through all of that?
I didn't really start gigging until, I think my first show was 1993. Mm-hmm. It was me and then two of the other guys from Sudden Death. What happened was in 1990, we got our first play on the Dr. Demento show.
Okay.
And I was like, this is awesome. You know, we need to put out more songs and keep going. And the guys were like, nah, whatever. Mm-hmm. So at that point, I decided to take the lead in the group. And the other guys kind of faded back. One of them took the opportunity to quit the group altogether. Mm-hmm. And then I said, okay, well, I'll expand Sudden Death into the type of hip-hop group I've always envisioned it, which is like a Digital Underground type group or a Wu-Tang Clan type group, where there's a whole bunch of people, but there's one or two people in the lead. Mm-hmm. And I was going to be the lead person and have everybody else back me up. So in 1993, I did my first gig at a club where it was like, it was, you know, I had put out a home-produced CD album, full-length, like 2 years before, and then this was the release of my second home-produced cassette album, and I was friends with the DJ at the club, so he was like, yeah, I'll give you 15 minutes of stage time, so I went there and performed, and the crowd loved me. Didn't sell a damn CD, but the crowd loved me. And then it was like real quiet until my next gig was at Alcon in 1998, which was a Weird Al fan convention that took place in Chicago. And then I did that gig. And then 2 years later, it was Alcon 2000. I performed there. And that was also, 2000 was my first sci-fi con. Not the first one I had attended, but the first one I performed at, which was Icon in Long Island.
Okay, yeah.
And Dr. Demento was a guest at Icon. So I called him up and I said, well, you know, you have your cabaret. Dr. Demento's hosting the cabaret. I've been on the Dr. Demento show. Can I perform at the cabaret? And, you know, and they were like, fine, you know, very reluctantly let me on. And I've performed at Icon every year since, except this year because it happens to coincide with my wife's birthday. So I won't be there this year.
Right.
But, and then it's been increasing ever since. I've been performing at more and more cons. I try to do like one good show a month now. I performed at MarsCon at the beginning of March. I just did RavenCon a couple of weeks ago. I'm doing PenguinCon at the end of the month. I've got a couple other cons coming up. I'm doing Nerdapalooza for the third time or fourth time. I did 2009, 2010. This will be the third time.
Yeah.
So, no, fourth time. 2008 was the first one. 8, 9. Yeah, so it's the fourth time at Nerdapalooza. So, I'm doing a lot of gigs now.
Okay.
It was a very, very slow evolving process. I didn't start taking my music seriously and start thinking about doing it possibly as a career until about 2003, 2004.
And what, you know, because I know We have a mutual friend in Murr Lafferty, and Murr is the person sort of introduced me to you online, and she's like, you guys should get to know each other a little bit. And this is actually the first time we're meeting in person. But, you know, she's like, you're both in New Jersey. You're both doing, you know, music. And, you know, John, your music's a little bit funny sometimes. And, like, you guys should, you know, get together. And, you know, I had never really thought about playing at cons until, you know, the past year. And now I have, you know, now I've been doing it a little bit. And I've been doing it more and more, and I'll be playing at Balticon, which you're going to be.
I'll be there, yeah. Too, so we can do our good cop, bad cop.
Yes, that would be great, and we'll have to work something out with all that stuff, and you know, and I have a couple of other ones coming up, and I'm curious as to what your, you know, I guess, you know, just because this is me just being very selfish and asking, like, what your, you know. What sort of your game plan is in terms of, like, playing all the cons? Because, you know, I know for myself, it's like, I've really enjoyed playing them, but it's, you know, I haven't made a whole lot of money playing the cons, and I don't expect to. So what do you get out of playing the cons? You know, and if you do get money, that's fine too, but I think there's other reasons to do it. And I'm curious as to know what your reasons for playing the cons.
It's a little bit of everything. It's in this day and age, you have to build your fan base one fan at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And playing at a con will get you the type of exposure, you know, that my music will get. Comedy rap mm-hmm. is impossible to market.
Mm-hmm.
Like, talking from experience here, it's impossible to market.
Mm-hmm.
Although I've actually had good success targeting fans with Django.
Okay.
Which is you know, a website similar to Pandora.
Okay.
But you know, at a con, there are people who appreciate the nerdy music. There are people who mm-hmm. appreciate the comedy music, and there are people who can tolerate the hip hop. There's not a whole lot of hip hop fans in mm-hmm. in fandom, but there's people who can tolerate it, and there's a few who like it. So I'm building my fan base one at a time. There have been cons where I've made a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the first Nerdapalooza, I made a ton of money, mm-hmm. you know, because that I had a new album out at the time. It was the first time these people had seen me. So I sold a ton of CDs, ton of t-shirts, and, you know, mm-hmm. I made good money at Nerdapalooza.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, I didn't make anything because I had the same stuff. I hadn't released a new album.
Right.
So, but, you know, this year coming up, I've got the new album out, so, and I'm going to have a new t-shirt design, so I should do okay this year. But yeah, it's, you know, I try not to go into it expecting to make a ton of money. I try to at least break even. Mm-hmm. So I do cons on the cheap. You know, I rarely stay at the con hotel.
Uh-huh.
You know, I there's usually a Super 8 within a mile or two of the hotel, which is usually like a third of the price. Mm-hmm. And then I'll split that room with one of the other artists who's coming. So, you know, I do cons on the cheap.
Yeah, I've done, you know, I've expanded out a little bit, but everyone that I've been to in the past year, like, when I went to Balticon last year, I have a friend that lives about a half hour outside of Baltimore, mm-hmm. and I stayed with him,
mm-hmm.
which was a little bit of a drag because, like, I didn't get the full con experience because I would split at, like, 11 o'clock, you know? So
half-hour drive is a lot. But Balticon,
it's a little much, yeah.
There's a hotel, like, right around the corner, which is really cheap, which I stay at.
Yeah, so, you know, and Balticon was the first one that I went to where I really felt, like, part of the community and sort of felt like, oh, you know, when you're doing all this stuff online and you sort of start getting people, you're finding out that people like what you're doing, it's a great feeling. And for me, it was because I know my experience with doing music was essentially playing, you know, folk singer songwriter gigs for years at, you know, coffee shops and things like that. And, you know, doing like rock band shows and at bars and stuff, and had a couple of good shows over the years and had a little bit of momentum going at one point. But then you just start to realize, at least my experience was you start to play to mostly disinterested audiences that aren't necessarily there to see you. And it is, you get a little, the feeling that I had was that as I was getting older and I got married and we had a son, it was sort of like, well, why am I doing this? Like, I'm going out, like, no one is really here to see me.
Yeah.
And I started to lose a little bit of my, I hate even use this word, but this is what's coming out, my passion for, like, doing music. And I sort of scaled back and I didn't do anything for about a year or two.
And then when I started doing the sci-fi song stuff that I do, and then later on some of the more humorous stuff, you know, I did it solely because I thought it would be fun, and that I thought, well, these are the two things that I like, and I'm going to do it, and I'll just put it online, and if some people like it, cool, and if they don't, well, I'm just having fun recording. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course, that's when you start getting fans, when yes. you actually start doing what you really want.
Yes.
And I know for me, the other great thing about it for me was that I think, and I don't know if hip-hop's the same way, but I know in, you know, sort of pop singer-songwriter stuff, certainly in rock music, it's like there's sort of a bit of, or was at least, kind of an age thing where it's like, once you get past a certain age, it's like you're not supposed to be doing this anymore.
Hip-hop has traditionally been very ageist. I mean, I remember in 1986, I remember I was in a tennis lesson, and there was another... Now, this was back when most people still didn't even know what hip-hop was. And I was talking to this other guy who I knew was a rap fan, and we were talking about what bands we like, and I mentioned Run DMC, and he goes, oh, they're old. This is 1986. He's telling me that they're old.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what? And I'm like, first of all, who cares? They're like the best yeah. rappers out there. But, you know, if Jam Master Jay wasn't shot a couple of years ago, they'd still be on tour doing great stuff. That's changing because mostly because my generation who grew up on hip hop are getting older and we don't care so much anymore. But hip hop has always been a genre for the young.
Yeah, I know, and that's, you know, I know for me, I thought, you know, especially like doing like various kinds of rock music over the years when I was younger, I thought the ageism was stupid when I was young. When I was 18 yeah, or 19, I thought, well, this is dumb because I always hated the, I always hated it, and if you've ever done any music, I'm sure you've heard this before, it's like, we're going to get signed, and we're going to do, and like, at 18, I thought that was ridiculous. I always thought, why don't we just try to be the biggest band on our college campus? Or why don't we just, you know, I always had like these very realistic kind of goals. I never really thought about it. But you can't be in a band and not have at least one guy that's has the stars in their eyes, and it's like, we're gonna make it, we gotta make it because my life sucks and we have to make it.
See, I always had the opposite problem. I had people in my group who had no drive whatsoever. So they were like, yeah, you do whatever you want to be, though.
We'll probably be back here. Well, it's, you know, it wasn't so much the drive never bothered me, it was more of a misplaced sort of you know, ideas in terms of like trying, like the point I was going to make was that, you know, what I'm so excited about now is that it seems like with everybody having the ability to kind of get their music out there, because it's just technologically it's much easier to do. Well, it's possible now where it wasn't.
Yeah. And I'm going to say for the record, I am so glad that when I was growing up and doing the recording those first, you know, 100 or so Sudden Death songs, that we did not have the internet and MySpace, because I would have put that stuff up there and I would have been so proud of it. And that stuff, it will never see the light of day.
Oh, yeah. I was talking to, I did a podcast for, her name is Julia Sherritt. She does this podcast called The Geeky Pleasure. It's like a radio show out of Canada. And she talks to a lot of like these sort of geek singer songwriters, and, you know, she talks about like, well, what do you do to make a good song and all this stuff? And I'm like, well, you just have to write a bunch of them and you have to record a bunch of them. And I basically said the same thing to her. I'm like, I was doing this all through my late teens and 20s, and I wrote literally hundreds of songs that will never see the light of day that were pretty awful, and it took a couple of hundred songs in to start writing some good ones.
Yeah.
And, you know, now you get to the point where it's like, yeah, some of your songs are better than others, but there's a level of consistency. I think what you'd notice is that when you're starting to write something, you're starting to work on something, you could tell if it's going to be good or not. And yeah. if it's not going to be good, you generally
just scrap it
and move on.
Yeah.
You know, so I feel the same way. I'm glad there is not MySpace pages with 50 of those songs that, you know, are terrible. But the thing that I do like now in terms of like the ageist thing, it seems like, you know, I'm 37 now. And, you know, to me, 37, that was so old, you know, when I was in my early 20s. And it's like, you aren't supposed to be still doing this at 37. You were supposed to.
You know, it's funny. I'm 38. Uh-huh. When I was a kid, I think Curtis Blow was 37, 38 when I first picked up his albums, which was, you know, ancient in hip-hop terms. But he still had a career and people still liked him. Well, so maybe it wasn't as bad as I
Well, you know what? It was. Here's the thing. I don't think it's... I think in the ages thing, I don't think it's so much that you can't be older and still make records. It's sort of like you can't sort of start your career.
You can't be the cool kids in high school anymore.
Yes.
You know?
Like, yeah, I remember about 10 years ago when I really got pretty serious about gigging and doing singer-songwriter stuff. I remember John Mayer's first record came out. And I remember thinking, I was 27 when I was really pushing this. And, you know... I thought when he came out, I thought he was like 23 or 24. I'm a couple years older than him. And I'm like, God damn it, I'm too old already. Because like, this is the new guy and he's 23 and like, well, fuck, screw it. You know, like I, you know, but what the thing is like someone like Jonathan Coulton, who I think is 40 now, he didn't, you know, his success doesn't start until he's in his mid-30s. So I don't think age really matters so much anymore, especially if you're doing some sort of niche music.
Yeah.
Because I think the people who are fan, and I can't speak to your fans, but I know the people who like what I do, they're my age or older. I mean, I think there's some who are younger than me, but it's
the,
like...
The artists who perform at Nerdapalooza, most of them are in their 30s, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a bunch of groups that are younger, but I think most of them are in their 30s.
Yeah, I think our generation is kind of like this... I think we're different than previous generations in that. It's like, no, I want to keep doing this.
Yeah.
And I want to do it in a way that is, and I think, you know, from knowing about your music, you want to do it in a way that is authentic to who you are at 38 years old. Not some, you know, the saddest thing in the world is if you go to some bar and you see a cover band of guys in their late 30s or 40s who are just really trying to hold on to being 21.
Yeah.
And that's sad, and I never wanted to do that. That to me was something that was like, no, I'll never do that. And I think, you know, it's okay to do whatever you want now. And if you want to write, you know, hip-hop tunes that are funny, you do it. And if you want to write songs about science fiction, you just do it. And, you know, even if your
audience... The trick is finding your audience.
Yeah, absolutely. And what was your trick in terms of finding... And now you obviously said you're doing it one fan at a time.
Yeah.
I realized I
very early on targeted the Dr. Demento show because that was how Weird Al got discovered. That's how he got his start. And I figured I could follow that same path.
Uh-huh.
The mistake I made was focusing too heavily on the Dr. Demento show because... Unbeknownst to me, radio was being gobbled up by these big mega corporations.
Mm.
They were pushing the Dr. Demento show off the air. So when Al was getting famous on the show, Dr. Demento was on 250 stations worldwide. 2007, when I dominated the Dr. Demento show, I had the number one, number two, number four most requested songs of the year, which even Al hasn't done. Mm. He was only on 27 stations at the time. So basically roughly one-tenth of the market I reached than Al reached.
Uh-huh.
So, but... You know, now it's like Dr. Demento's internet only. He still has a huge fan base, but he doesn't have the pull that he had in 1980 when he was on 250 mainstream radio stations. And because of that, I was focusing so much on going national with Dr. Demento, I didn't do anything locally.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I wasn't touring locally. You know, once in a while I'd do a show in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't do any radio station interviews or send singles out to local stations to try to build a local fan base or anything like that, which is how you're supposed to do it, you know, classically, is you start locally and then branch out. I kind of did it the other way.
Mm-hmm.
And then as a result, my fan base is scattered all over the country.
Right.
So... Which is fine in the internet age because everyone can buy my album online. But doing a show, a live show, is tough. It's really hard for me to get people to come to my show.
Mm-hmm.
Which is part of the reason I like doing cons, because there's a built-in audience there. You've got 1,000 people or, you know, in the case of Icon, you've got 7,000 people in one place at one time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can pretty much bet that a certain number of them will come to see you if for nothing else to do at the con. You know?
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, at a con, I will typically have a good audience at my show. And from performing at these various cons, I've started to build a name for myself. on the con circuit.
Mm-hmm.
So people have started to recognize me. And, you know, I just got an email the other day from a guy who, you know, said, is it true you're not going to be at ICON this year? You know, I'm really upset. And I was like, yeah, I'm sorry. It's my wife's birthday. And he goes, oh, well, wish her a happy birthday then. I went, okay.
So what's sort of the plan from this point on for you? I know you have, why don't you tell everyone about your new album that's out and what it's about and some of the things that you've been doing. I know I was following you on Twitter the other day when you were talking about getting it up the hip hop charts on iTunes. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. I finally got this album together after 3 years. I was planning to put it out like a year and a half ago. And then all sorts of things happened outside of my music career that screwed up those plans and didn't happen. I finally, you know, sat down with a calendar and said, okay, what's the, you know, earliest I can realistically do it? And I decided April 1st was a good date because it's a date that people will remember. Hey, there's a comedy album coming out on April 1st. You know, I can remember that. And what I decided to do with this album was an iTunes rush. And I got this idea from some of my author friends, like Merle Lafferty and Scott Sigler have both done this, where they have a book coming out on a certain date. They ask all their fans to buy it on that same date on Amazon, and that pushes them up the Amazon charts, which gets them more publicity and visibility.
Sure.
I wanted to see if the same thing could be done on iTunes. So I asked all my fans to buy it on iTunes on April 1st. And as an incentive to do this, I said, if you do this, I'll send you the physical CD of the album, which is called Noam Saying, and I'll send you a bonus CD, which is called Namin. So for, you know, the $10 iTunes charge, you get two CDs. And much to my surprise, it worked. I made it up to number 28 on the hip-hop charts on iTunes. I almost cracked the top 200 overall. I was at about number 224 when that was the last time. I was about the highest I was able to check it on the overall charts. So I didn't quite make the top 200 overall, but, you know, number 28 on the hip-hop charts is much better than I was expecting.
Sure.
I really thought I'd be lucky to crack the top 200 in the hip-hop charts on iTunes. But so I made it up to number 28. And was thrilled and was kind of buzzing around for about a week after that. And, you know.
Now, do you think there was, by doing that, do you think there were people that checked out your album that wouldn't have otherwise just because it got up on the charts a little bit?
That's what I'm hoping.
Yeah.
And I won't know that until for a couple of months because there's a real lag from the time that iTunes reports to CD Baby and then they report to me.
Sure.
So it's probably going to be about 2 months before I get the actual numbers.
Cool. Yeah, and I have one of my albums up on CD Baby, which then puts it to iTunes and Amazon and all that. And it's great because I think some people will only buy from iTunes.
I had a couple people take part in the rush and they said, don't bother sending me the CD. I don't want it.
Yeah.
You know, they just took part in the rush to help me out.
Yeah.
But you know, I gave them the download, you know, they got the download for iTunes and I gave them the download of the bonus CD. So they have all the music. They just don't feel the need for the physical CD.
Yeah. You know, and I have a physical CD and I have more than enough stuff to put another album out and I should just probably go and do it and make the physical copy. I've just been putting my stuff out through Bandcamp and I really like Bandcamp a lot. I don't know if you're using that.
No, I haven't used that one.
Well, I can tell you
there's so many of those websites. I don't know which ones are worth doing.
Well, Bandcamp's worth doing, but you know, the point I was going to make about the physical CDs is that, and if I play more cons where people actually buy CDs, it's probably worth, you know, the effort to go and put it out. But you know, I've made way more money on Bandcamp than I've made on iTunes.
Just really,
yeah,
interesting.
Yeah, Bandcamp's interesting because, I like a bunch of things about it. First of all, You upload your tracks as WAV files, and then they'll convert it to all the different ones. So people, the default is like a 320K MP3, and then, but if people want like, you know, FLAC and OGVORB, like all those different, they can get them like that. So I like that there's some flexibility there. And you can do the whole, and this is what I do. You can set any price you want. You can do name your price, where you can have stuff just flat out free. And what I like about that is you can have it where essentially they have to sign your mailing list to get it free. So I know the thing that I've really liked about Bandcamp is it's really helped to build up my mailing list. I used to put stuff out for free on my website, and I used to get more downloads than I get through Bandcamp. But
I don't know how, you know, how valuable all those downloads are. I feel like if someone, I want someone at least willing to give me their email address. I want them to have at least that sense of value in my music. And you know what? That sounds so stupid, but like, I know for myself, giving up your email address, there is value in that,
yeah.
You know, because like, I don't do it that easily. Yeah. 'Cause it's like, I don't want to get spammed by this dude, you know? Yeah. So, you know, to me, I like Bandcamp just in terms of being able to build up your mailing list. What I like about it too, is that I'll put out singles on Bandcamp. So I'll do something where it's like, I'll have the fully recorded version and then I'll do like an acoustic mix and it's like a double-sided single. And there you go. That's your new thing you're working on. Put that out, do Name Your Price or do 99 Cents. So it's a way where you can kind of keep putting your tunes out without having like a big album release.
Mm-hmm.
I like it for the singles. That's really been fun to do it that way. If you have a new tune that you're really excited about and you really want to get it out there, you know, you can get it out there. You kind of focus on that one song too. I know living in this like sort of niche world and this like world where it's like, what's the, you know, the meme of the week or what have you.
Yeah.
I think sort of focusing on one song sometimes isn't so bad. But anyway, Bandcamp is definitely worth checking out. I really like it because you're right. You get, there's all those things. There's like Reverb Nation. There's all this stuff. And I'm like, I don't. But
yeah, I signed up for Reverb Nation and I thought it was cool because I was, you know, looking around and discovering some other artists. And it's like, it's done nothing for me. Absolutely.
Yeah, I've never, I'm very slow to sign up for stuff, but I started doing Bandcamp in last summer and I really like it. But
so I'll check that out.
Yeah, definitely worth checking. So why don't we plug away on everything else. So you got the album out, Gnome Sane.
New album is called Gnome Sane. It's two words, Gnome, G-N-O-M-E, and then Sane, S-A-N-E, as in Gnome Sane.
Yeah.
And so that is now available at, it's up on the store at thefump.com, the Funny Music Project, thefump.com. It will be up on my website. I think it cross-pollinates to my website automatically, but I'm not advertising it yet because I just got the CDs the other day. So
yeah.
So my website is devospice.com. You can also find my music at The Fump at thefump.com, which is the Funny Music Project.
Which we'll have to talk more about at another time if we can do another interview. Paul's kind of, I can't believe we didn't even get to The Fump. That's so funny. Which is just the Funny Music Project. And what else do you have? And you're on Twitter at...
I'm on Twitter at devospice. I'm on Facebook under my real name, Tom Rockwell. Just I'm the one with the Transformers face. I don't know what else I can plug. I think that about covered.
Well, you know,
I do have a neglected MySpace page that's under sudden death still because somebody else has Devo Spice, oddly.
Wow, yeah.
Some girl in England. I don't know what she's doing with it. But.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I will plug, I don't know if we mentioned it over the course of the interview, but Devo and I will both be performing at Balticon, which is a science fiction convention in Baltimore, and it is Memorial Day weekend. I don't know the exact dates off the top of my head, but that should be a great time. I think you guys are performing on Friday night, and I think there's
a Fump concert Friday night, and then I think we're doing individual concerts later in the weekend.
Okay, and I know mine is Saturday night at like 9 o'clock. And I don't know if Murr is doing a live podcast again, but if she is, Murr, if you're listening to this, I'll definitely do the I Should Be Writing song to start. And I think, Devo and I will definitely do the Good Cop, Bad Cop song for you as well if you're still doing that. So anyway, so if you're at Balticon, you know, definitely come hang out.
I don't know if Matt's going to be there. So.
I don't think he is, but anybody else. But all right, well, Devo, thanks so much for joining me tonight. Well, thanks for having me in your home tonight.
Thanks for having me. Yeah.
And that was the dog. If you've heard
the jingling is my psychotic dog.
Yeah.
We managed to keep quiet long enough to do the interview.
Yeah. All right. Thanks.
And we're back. Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview with one Devo Spice. I want to thank him again for having me in his home. Again, this week I have the Books, Bites, and Bots EP out, so go and check that out, please. You can also, and that's at johnanilio.bandcamp.com. You can also follow me at twitter.com/johnanilio. Patrick, what do you have going on this week?
Nothing, but I'm still exhausted.
I hear you.
There's a possibility that if everything goes right tomorrow, which is Monday, because we're recording this on Sunday, even though the podcast comes out on Tuesday, there's a possibility that I'll be doing an interview Monday night with Mikio Kaku, who is the guy who co-founded String Theory. He's a cool guy. He's on Science Channel. And I'm trying to do that for SF Signal. And so if that happens, that's going to go live on Thursday. If that doesn't happen, it's not going to go live on Thursday, and I still got nothing.
Oh, we guys can interview me.
No, I mean, I've got other interviews, but I was hoping to do the Mikio Kaku one this week. It was, you know, I'm there's a turn of phrase that I'm thinking about inventing. It's essentially where someone incredibly famous agrees to come on the podcast, and then on the night or the evening of the interview, we call and call and call, and they don't answer.
Yeah, I think I know what that phrase would be.
and so, you know, Thursday night, DiNardo and I are sitting there calling this cell phone and getting voicemail. And, you know, each time we call, we try like every 5 or 10 minutes. And each time we call, we get a little bit more depressed. You know, it's like, ah, we were so excited. Ah, this sucks so bad. And so, you know, we finally gave up and just said, oh, well, we left a voicemail. I sent an email to the publicist. And I'm like, you know, if there's an opportunity to reschedule, we'd love to reschedule and have this conversation with Professor Kaku. And about 10 o'clock, my cell phone rings. And I answer it, and it's Mikio Kaku.
Uh-huh.
Apologizing.
Yeah.
He accidentally turned his cell phone off.
Ah. Well, what are you going to do?
Well, and DiNardo had theorized that maybe Professor Kaku had gotten lost in space-time.
As would be the case with him, yeah.
Yeah. So hopefully that all comes together tomorrow, which we're recording this today, and then it'll go live on Thursday. Other than that, you know what? I've kind of hunkered down and just been doing writing. So
good. I'm glad to hear that. Anyway, next week on the Functional Nerds podcast, we will have Tom Brislin. And I actually recorded that interview already. I actually recorded that interview a couple weeks ago. Tom is a singer-songwriter. He's also an excellent keyboardist and actually has been the touring keyboardist for big name people. Like, he toured with Meatloaf and Deborah Harry, and believe it or not, even Yes, the progressive rock superstars. He was the keyboardist in Yes, even though the dude is like a year younger than me. he did a Yes tour. So sat down with him, super nice guy. That interview is really good. So look forward to that one next week. Also check out functionalnerds.com. Patrick did a big redesign of the site, and I think it's really awesome looking now.
Thank you.
It's really great. I'm very happy and pleased and excited about sort of the community of people that are contributing to our site. Got a lot of good reviewers, people writing columns, and, you know, they're just doing a great job and are just, I don't know, they're making me very excited about Functional Nerds. Like, I don't know, this started as just Patrick and I wanting to get together to BS, and now it's kind of blossoming into this big site, and I couldn't be happier about it. So go and check that out.
So, John, do you know what's going on there, like, this week as this podcast is going? So we have Kate Sherrod has a new Sunday Comics pickup.
Mm-hmm. Read that.
We have Kathy Russell has mm-hmm. another review going up. John Remy wrote mm-hmm. the Food Nerd column, which cool. is a debut piece. We haven't
awesome.
Done for yeah. anybody yet. So that's going to go live here in a few days. And Sandra Wickham has up a new Fitness Nerd piece. That is no excuses. And we got more book reviews coming up. I mean, we've got a lot of people writing stuff, which is awesome.
Yeah.
I'm also working on video games. So I'm getting like a couple people who are going to write some stuff about video games.
Great. Great. Very good. Very good. So go and check all that out. And we are going to close out the podcast with one of Devo Spice's tunes. I believe it's Platform Wars that we're going to close it out with. So go and check it out and go check out Devo's music as well. All right, everybody. Have a great week. We'll see you next time.
Bye.
Hello, I'm a Mac.
And I'm a PC. You can see me in homes wherever you happen to be.
Not to mention landfills and a couple of dumps, because you need to be replaced every couple of months. Macs, on the other hand, last for years.
Because it takes you that long for you to dry your tears when you realize you spent enough to renovate some rooms, and the only software you can run is iTunes. I got software that can do anything, from run the space shuttle
to help you sing.
They help you write when you get stuck, invest to make a quick buck, millions of titles.
Yeah, and all of them suck. They got a clunky interface, and they're
waste too much space, and they crash a damn much. Your table needs a leg brace. You should really try a Mac.
Sorry, but no, I won't. You think I like the iMac and iPod? Well, I don't.
Hello, I'm a Mac,
and I'm a PC.
Hello, I'm a Mac,
and I'm a PC.
Hello.